A Hero's Journey is a podcast filled with spoilers. We recommend reading the book each week before you listen, but we trust you to make your own decision.
Hi, and welcome to A Villain's Journey into Ultimate Victory. Or a Hero's Journey podcast. I'm your host and Judge Jack, and I'm here with my devilish Death Eaters.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
Each week, we normally look at a different book through Joseph Campbell's monomyth, but this week, we're looking at How to Rule the World through Joseph Campbell's monomyth.
Yes, as Jack has stated, we're looking at the Harry Potter series as a whole this week, all seven books. And we're talking about everybody's favorite character, Tom Riddle. Tom Riddle is working to reclaim his rightful place as head of the wizarding world, and he meets a few obstacles along the way, and we're going to discuss those.
To start where any good world conqueror begins, much like Genghis Khan, we start at our humble origins and our departure from the ordinary.
So the call to adventure for our journey to start to reclaim our rightful place as the head of the Wizarding World is to get to being the head of the Wizarding World. And this all starts with being an extremely bright student at Hogwarts from an old and distinguished wizarding family. We have a quote here from the book that Dumbledore has even admitted himself. Riddle was regarded as one of the most brilliant students to ever attend Hogwarts. Which pretty much cements him as one of the brightest wizards of any era. Our refusal of the call is Riddle often showcases a facade to other students, the faculty of Hogwarts, a persona of not just a smart student, which he definitely is, but someone who is not evil by nature. And I think had he really played into these elements more so than he did and started to make them kind of part of who he was, he could have eventually perhaps reformed himself. Every time he portrays himself as this good person at heart, he is not giving into his true nature, which is his desire to conquer the world. For a meeting of the mentor, we have Slughorn, who is a professor at Hogwarts and who really admires Tom Riddle and his genius and wishes to help him in his academic studies. One of which is a scholarly discussion on what a Horcrux is and how they prolong a wizard's life and how maybe even more than one can be created. Slughorn later states it was one of his biggest regrets. These discussions he had with Tom Riddle. But at the time, it was just a scholarly interest after all. As Tom Riddle matures at Hogwarts, he comes to find that he has an adversary in Albus Dumbledore who sees through his persona that he portrays and is keeping annoyingly careful watch on Tom Riddle. But he grows up, gathers a large force, and begins the first wizarding war. It's not until later that Voldemort is informed of a prophecy by Snape that was told by Trelawney in Hogshead, a pub for wizards that was owned by Albus's brother, that tells of a child who will be born on a certain day, I believe it was the end of October, who comes from a family that's defied him three times and who could be his downfall. So this prophecy and knowing what could defeat him is the crossing of the threshold. Now he has to commit to this because if he doesn't, he will surely be defeated. Well, Belly of the Whale is his first quote unquote death and the creation of who Harry Potter is to be. He, through the betrayal of Wormtongue, and the infiltration of the Potter's home and the killing of Harry's parents, and then the protective charm that's laid on Harry, Voldemort ends up killing himself, and he was ripped from his, as Voldemort says himself, I was ripped from my body, less than a spirit, less than the meanest ghost, but still, I was alive. And this is because of the many Horcrux that he has created. And as such, it begins our true journey here, which is to reclaim his now right, his place that he's been dethroned from as the head of the wizarding world.
This is interesting. I think one of the kind of fun aspects of this is we have a kind of dual call to adventure. His first adventure when he gets to Hogwarts for the first time, and then his second call to the same adventure when his body is taken from him, is ripped away from him. But we'll talk about this. One just correction, the prophecy was for a boy born at the end of summer. The attack on the Potters happened on Halloween, but that's not a big deal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, it was the seventh month, wasn't it?
I don't know if they ever said a month. It was just like the end of summer, but it might have been a month. I don't remember.
It's like in the third month following. So it 3 months before Halloween, or there's some weird thing that means that it is the end of summer.
Okay. So our journey, I'm not really going to argue. I think that this is Voldemort's goal, stated goal from fairly early on. One thing that I will kind of quibble with is this call to adventure. I don't think Riddle needs to know any of this information to have his call to adventure. I think Dumbledore coming to him and telling him he is a wizard is enough for Tom Riddle to start on this goal of conquering the wizarding world. He already believes that he is better than everyone. We can tell that from the memories that Dumbledore and Harry look at. And he would automatically, I think, believe that he is from an old wizarding family, from a powerful family. So
he's kind of right.
He is. And I think just, we don't need him to be
the wrong places at first.
Yeah, we don't need him to be a bright student first. I think just hearing that he is from the wizarding world is enough for his call to adventure.
I will say, if we want to focus on what triggers Tom isn't loved the way that he should be, which is right meant to be like why he ends up bad, because love magic, yada yada yada, but finding out that his mother was a wizard and died powerless and poor and left him is kind of what breaks him, right? That's why he then goes and kills his Muggle family and Horcrux.
Yeah, so it's also that when he changes his name.
That's when he assumes the title.
Yeah.
So I'm good with that as a call.
Okay, so we could just sometime between finding out he's a wizard and killing his parents, his father. Is that call to adventure?
Some good old patricide really brings the adventure to you.
Once again, welcome to our patricide podcast.
For our refusal of the call here, this doesn't fit at all for me. How can you gain followers and attract people to gain power if you're not putting on a good face, a likable face? Presentation is important, and Tom Riddle knows this. That's what he's doing with this facade, as you call it.
See, I disagree, because there's many instances in which we kind of see behind the scenes of what's happening here. And
so, Zach, as a sociopath who developed a small following in college, what stopped you from using your power for evil? Was it love?
Well, first of all, that's a rather big assumption. If you ask half of the players of Humans versus Zombies, they would, in fact, inform you that what I did was, in fact, evil. No, I think if we look behind the scenes at some of Tom Riddle's actions at this point, I remember it being discussed that the people he had following him, he did not, you know, outwardly, other people thought they were his friends, but really they were his servants and his pretty much his gang. And that the people who were attracted to him were people who were already cruel, who wanted someone to show them new ways to be cruel, or people who were afraid of him, right? these aren't people with whom he has genuine human connections.
And again, how does that...
How is that a refusal of the call?
No, I'm. This is to refute Alex's specific point. That how do you attract people if you're not coming across as good?
Okay, potentially. I mean, he remains charming to them, though, at least initially. He doesn't start being... He gets them to love him, and then he starts being cruel to them, is what we see. Right, when he eventually... You're right. He drops that with his inner circle, and they have them call him Voldemort, Lord Voldemort. Right? Can you imagine having that conversation? Could you imagine having that conversation with your friend group? By the way,
I'm the man formerly known as Tom Riddle, but shall now be called Voldemort.
Yeah, in private, can you call me Lord Voldemort? No, it's not a sex thing, guys.
Actually, don't even call me Voldemort. Just say Dark Lord. No one should ever say my name.
Yeah, we're gonna. Here's the name, but if you say it again, I'm gonna be mad.
So I agree with that part, Zach. But what I don't think holds up in your refusal is the idea that Tom was ever at risk of falling into that persona in a real state. I think all the evidence we see shows that by the time we hit that end of the call, when he's decided that the only answer is to be immortal and powerful and rule, there's nothing that's going to pull him off that path. The only thing close to the refusal would have been Dumbledore not being Dumbledore and actually, you know, giving a shit about a kid.
For the meeting the mentor here, I actually like Slughorn. I don't think the Horcruxes make too much of an appearance in this journey that you've set out to reclaim his place as head of the wizarding world, but in another journey where we set the goal of gaining immortality, which would essentially follow the same path, this would be a more important point. The difference in this quest to gain immortality, I think, would be in our crossing the threshold and belly of the whale. In the quest to gain immortality, the crossing the threshold would be making his first Horcruxes when he kills his parents, and then his grandparents and father, not his mother. And then a belly of the whale would be still hearing the prophecy and going after Harry, because that is the thing that could hold him back from immortal life. That's the thing that could kill him. So either way, I really like the Slughorn and the Horcruxes here. For this journey and our crossing the threshold, I think hearing the prophecy is pretty good, because like you said, this is the threat to him that he has to deal with. And there is an introduction of danger here, whereas before, while Tom feared Voldemort, I don't think he viewed him as a danger. He was more of an obstacle. This old man is not a danger to Tom as much as the prophecy about a new adversary is. Our last thing here, the belly of the whale. I don't like this point for a journey of reclaiming his place at the head of the wizarding world, because I think he was already committed. I don't think he could have turned back even before this happened. I see this, like I said at the beginning here, as a kind of second call to adventure. His adventure changes a little bit, and that he has to come back into a body before he can continue his quest for power. But his quest for power already had that kind of point of no return.
All right. Well, let's take a look at our definition. Represents the final separation from the hero's known world. And by entering the stage, they show a willingness to undergo a metamorphosis. And they may also encounter a minor danger or setback.
I see no willingness to undergo a metamorphosis.
He explicitly does not want to change.
He changes, undergoes a setback, and what was that last bit? Oh, yeah, separates himself from his known world at this point. This is a experience that, for many intents and purposes, we're led to believe is something that is a unique Voldemort wizarding experience, right? This isn't even something that other wizards have experienced.
That one dude who made the one other Horcrux might have, you never know.
Okay, this is not a very common wizarding experience.
I think the crossing of the threshold works for me. It establishes a danger, and it takes Voldemort from a now known situation, which is his reign of his rise up, and sets up that he feels is inevitable and invincible, but he's not quite got all of the power that he wants. It's not what we see in book 7, where he is the de facto minister of magic. He's just on the rise. And then he hears this prophecy, he gets scared, he makes a mistake. I'm good with that as we're crossing the threshold. I agree with Alex that Voldemort is very committed to claiming his place before this, but given where our crossing the threshold is, it is hard for me not to see the forced separation of his body as anything other than a belly of the whale. I think because he did not fully have all of the power beforehand, that this puts him on what, this is what fully, this is where he makes Harry into his ultimate downfall. This is where he, to piss off Zach from last episode, creates the hero, even though I did not award him that. This is where he ultimately is responsible for his own undoing. So I'm fine with that as the belly for a villain. That's going to close us out on our departure with just that refusal of the call missing on Voldemort's journey to ultimate villainhood. Attaching ourselves to the back of a dude's head, as you do, we come to the initiation.
Yes, so for initiation, we have our road of trials here. Voldemort has to regain a body, if we're being very bland about it. He has to regain a corporeal form, if we're being more mystical about it. And to do so, he attempts several different situations to get that corporeal form. He attempts to use the Sorcerer's Stone in the first book with Professor Quirrell, although that falls short, but our hero is allowed to fail. Then he instigates a very elaborate sort of
scheme.
Yeah, it seems to be some sort of ancient magic. They don't really get into the details of it, but he gives himself, there's even one thing I saw online that mentioned it might be a spell that Voldemort himself created, that essentially created that in the movies was that little baby-ish body, but they called it something else in the spell book, even though I can't remember exactly what it was, rudimentary body or something. And that gets him most, you know, gets a large portion of the way there. He can't really do everything that he wants to do. He's not nearly at his full power, but it's a large step forward, and not one that was easy to do. And then at the end of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, he's able to bring himself fully into a corporeal body and, you know, kind of walk amongst the living in a meaningful way and with his full power intact. So good trials, things that he must overcome and things that he does overcome. For me, with the higher power, we have Wormton, which sounds a little odd, I will admit, as Wormton is a servant of Voldemort, but he's been extremely helpful to Voldemort. He's the one who makes it to the forest in Albania and discovers Voldemort's essence, his spirit there. He's the one that works with him to establish his, like we call it, the rudimentary body. And then he's the one who actually helps grant him the physical body that he now has by sacrificing his own hand and helping instigate Harry's arrival to the graveyard so that Harry's blood, along with Wormtail's hand and the bones of Voldemort's father, all combined, allowed Voldemort
to bone of the father unknowingly taken.
Given.
Flesh of the servant willingly given, blood of the enemy forcibly taken.
Yeah, something like that. And as such, Jack has been reborn as a new podcast host.
Hello, I am Evil Jack.
Our temptress for this journey is to ignore Harry Potter as insignificant. It's something that Voldemort does again and again for several reasons. One, Harry is a child who isn't a wizarding genius like Tom Riddle / Voldemort is and was. He doesn't have nearly the sort of support and followers that Voldemort. He doesn't have nearly the supporters and followers that Voldemort does. On a power scale, he pretty much falls below Voldemort on every occasion. And there's several instances. One of the things that he says when he fake kills Harry later on in book 7 was, see, he was something like, he was just a boy who only got this far because others were willing to die for him. Kind of hyping himself up that, yeah, Harry Potter wasn't anything. But what he doesn't realize is that there was that whole love magic that pretty much made Harry that one thing that Voldemort never had, which the prophecy foretold. So the temptation is to ignore Harry. And at certain times, you know, Voldemort seems to treat him as a real threat, especially in their final battle confrontation. But we see where that got him. Now, for the Atonement of the Creator, I have the taking of Hogwarts during the Battle of Hogwarts. Hogwarts has been instrumental in the creation of who Voldemort is today. Albus saving him from the orphanage to take him to Hogwarts, his discovery of his familial history and his relation to Slytherin. And since Hogwarts has been so instrumental to the creation of who Voldemort is today, his returning to it and taking of it for himself is his atonement with his creator. For apotheosis is realizing that he's got to stop kind of relying on others to kill Harry Potter. He has to be the one to do it himself. It's like kind of that Thanos line, right? He's been relying on others. Now he's going to do it himself and see that the job is done properly. And his ultimate boon is finally defeating Harry Potter, killing him, and having no threats left to his rule.
Starting off here with our Road of Trials, I see these as, you know, definitely tasks and things that Voldemort has to do, but how specifically do they help him get to his goal, except for getting a body back? Why couldn't Voldemort rule as this half ghost, undead creature that he is at the start of the Sorcerer's Stone?
It's mainly because he has no way to really do magic in this spirit form, right? He's mainly communicating with others who do the magic for him that eventually bring him back to a corporeal form. And you can't really be the head of the wizarding world if you're relying on everybody else to do everything for you. You have to have a little bit of might to back it up.
Well, doesn't he have like legions of devoted followers that will do his bidding?
Can't not just, really. Like, we learned that a majority of the Death Eaters, well, not a majority, but a large portion of the Death Eaters were followers of circumstance. You know, there's the really extreme ones who end up in Azkaban.
Fair weather cultists.
Yeah, and in fact, he even asked this questions to his own Death Eaters, like the Malfoys, when they show up in the graveyard scene at the end of book 4. He asked, you know, where were you guys this whole time? You weren't actively looking for me. You were just kind of hanging out, and it's taking you this long to come to my side even now. So they're not necessarily to be relied on.
Okay, also, I guess.
And again, you cannot be a political ruler from the back of a dude's head. I just feel that needs to be stressed, Alex.
All right, that's all fair. But going on to our meeting with the higher power, look, I know Wormtail does these things to get Voldemort out of Albania and help him reconnect with his follower, Barty Crouch Jr., and does technically give him what he needs to make his body, but come on, man. It's Wormtail. Wormtail's just doing this out of fear. He's not doing this out of benevolence or wanting to help Voldemort, really. It's all fear. He is fearful of Voldemort, even in this state where he is totally destroyed, like basically dead. So I cannot view him as a higher power.
So while I agree with you, Zach, that Wormtail does do something, I can't get past the fact that Voldemort directly tells us that everything Wormtail does is out of fear, as Alex says, and to be afraid of Voldemort, it feels as if that means Peter is giving Voldemort power over him.
So, Zach, for our Temptress, it kind of rings a little hollow to me. I don't think Voldemort views Harry as insignificant. Voldemort knows about Harry and wanted to meet Harry. Even in the Sorcerer's Stone, he says that he's been interested in him for a while. And then the next time we see Voldemort himself and not in a memory, he is definitely concerned about Harry. He views Harry as significant. He views him as so significant that he goes out of his way to come up with a very, very convoluted plan to get Harry to a graveyard.
That plan isn't to kill Harry. That is to get his body back.
Right.
And he treats Harry, the moment he has his body back, he begins to immediately underestimate Harry.
He specifically seeks Harry out to get his blood because he knows that Harry has a protection. And when he takes the blood from him, he thinks he is negating that protection. He doesn't view him as insignificant. He thought he solved the problem. As soon as he realizes he didn't solve the problem, he views Harry as significant again. He spends the whole next book, the fifth book, going after the prophecy so he can hear specifically how Harry is significant to him. Part of what Voldemort is doing, like dueling him in the Goblet of Fire, is trying to show his followers that he is powerful, that he has defeated this thing that is said to defeat him. He's not fighting Harry because he underestimates him or considers him insignificant. He thinks he has beaten him, and he's going to prove it by dueling him, and he's going to prove it to his followers to show them that he has strength and power again, to get them to fall back in line. And with the wands, Voldemort's not discounting Harry. He's saying, Harry is someone that I have to deal with. I think the wands are protecting him and not letting us duel fairly. So let's remove that obstacle so we can duel fairly. And in that case, I should win. He's not underestimating him.
How is he not underestimating him? Even in your description, right? You don't let somebody, you think you've beaten somebody, you don't let them go and then they win if you're not underestimating them. Otherwise, you wouldn't have let them go. He continually denies the reality in front of him that it can't be Harry, because that would mean that he has to accept that Voldemort is wrong, that he did something wrong in the beginning, right? That's the whole point of that love is, right? Dumbledore tells us repeatedly that Voldemort couldn't understand that why Harry would be the one to win, because Harry had love and Voldemort didn't.
In that case, I think we should push that realization to the apotheosis, this understanding that Harry is significant and that he can't be underestimated should be pushed to the apotheosis, because I think there's a better Temptress. And it's the same one that Harry faced in the seventh book, the Deathly Hallows, particularly the Elder Wand. But we don't really need to talk about that. I personally like that better as a Temptress. And I think it gives us a nice reflection between Harry and Voldemort.
But it's not the pursuit of the Elder Wand, it's his lack of understanding of
who was in charge.
Who was in charge of it that actually,
like, had he actually owned the Elder Wand, he probably still would have won that fight.
I mean, he probably still would have lost because it's a book. So Harry would have Deus Ex Machina his way out of it. But I get what you're going for, Alex. I really do, like, as you talk about, I like the symmetry and the parallel of the pursuit of the Hollows. Just with the journey that Zach has set us on, I'm not sure that the pursuit of the Hollows was intrinsically wrong for Voldemort in the way that it is for Harry, if that makes sense.
Okay, that's fine.
I mean, it is intrinsically wrong to want to be the master of death. That is the moral of Voldemort. But
well, let's not go that far. We don't need J.K. Rowling imposing her moral code on us.
Moving on to our atonement with the creator here, I actually don't have a huge problem with this. I think him trying to take Hogwarts is definitely atonement with the creator. He's returning to the school that kind of built him and returning to his ancestors' legacy with Salazar Slytherin. It it feels correct to me for that to be the atonement with the creator. My problem is he doesn't ever actually take Hogwarts.
He never controls it.
He's got everyone like in the courtyard ready to like be killed, and then Harry starts interfering.
He thinks he does during that scene before Longbottom fucking wrecks Nagini.
Right, so after Harry is dead, Voldemort walks with Harry to the school and says, okay, Harry's dead, you should all surrender now. Right, so he controlled Hogwarts, right? So he was able to just like kind of go up into the headmaster's office and go sit down, right?
Voldemort doesn't control it, but if we're talking about his perception, do you not think that Voldemort feels in that moment that he's received his homecoming?
He's riding that high.
I mean, yeah, he thinks he does, but that doesn't make it true. It's like, it's kind of similar to how you guys are saying he doesn't view Harry as a real threat. He thinks he's controlling Hogwarts. That's not true. He thinks that Harry isn't a real threat. That's not true either.
But this is different. This is a temptation versus a...
I mean, do you think when he's there standing before them saying that he's going to dissolve all the houses, that Voldemort isn't experiencing what he can for... the word I used was homecoming, because I think atonement with the creator doesn't quite fit for our villain, because... frankly, Voldemort never gets to come to Jesus.
Okay, well then you just kind of said it. I think he would have had that experience if he truly controlled Hogwarts. He would have had that come to Jesus, I guess you'd call it moment.
Have. Do you think Voldemort would have had a moment of honest eternal reflection? I don't know if he's capable.
Where he goes, you know, it wasn't worth it.
I'll give it to you. I will give it to you, Alex. That does mean that by putting him on our hero's journey, he does not fit in atonement with the creator, because the atonement requires some sort of catharsis or understanding, and that does not happen here.
Yes. All right. Good. I'm glad. I'm knocking the points down slowly, hopefully. For our apotheosis, realizing that he has to be the one to kill Harry Potter. I mean.
Is the wrong realization, Zach. I couldn't tell you at the time. It is provably wrong. As you yourself have said, if he just let other people kill Harry, he would have been fine. But Voldemort continually goes, no. I want it to mean something when I murder you.
The only other realization that he has at the end is when he dies. Or the realization that Harry is alive. Neither of which put him at the head of the Wizarding World.
He should have had the realization that the power of love is what's saving Harry, and he should defeat it with, like Jack said, having someone else kill him, or I'm sure there are other ways. Doing this non-magically probably would have worked too.
Have we tried a tactical nuclear strike on Hogwarts?
Okay, that's not the realization that he has, or anyone has. So what realization, big boy Jack, is the realization that Voldemort has?
He doesn't have one?
He doesn't have one.
Going on to the ultimate boon, then, I actually think that this is the ultimate boon. Voldemort thinks he has won. I mean, he hasn't actually, but in his mind, he has won. He defeated the only thing that could kill him. And there is a period of time where Harry's in this kind of limbo state. And I think that that instance where Harry's in the limbo state in his little scene with King's Cross, no matter if you view it as a dream sequence or something that really happens, Voldemort really won in that little split, however long the scene is supposed to take place in. But only then, only in that little second of time.
And for that moment was all he needed.
And that is going to bring us to a close on our initiation with a much more reasonable score of only 3 out of 6 points given to Voldemort. God, Campbell, I know you're good, but Voldemort is not a hero. And coming confusingly onto our return, we have a very swift fall from grace after a wonderful, wonderful victory. And if it wasn't for those meddling kids and their destroying of Horcruxes, he would have gotten away with it too.
So for the refusal of the return, Voldemort has a moment after he's quote unquote killed Harry, in which he sends someone else to check his vitals to make sure that he is dead. He unfortunately chooses the wrong person, someone who's invested in getting into Hogwarts to see if her son is alive, Malfoy's mom. And so he doesn't really believe it himself that he's claimed his victory. So he has to get confirmation, and this is his refusal of the return. For our magical flight, we have
there. He passes out. That's all you need.
For our magical flight, we have a brief moment of unconsciousness, and followed by a rather kind of statuesque, grandiose walk back to Hogwarts, which I think is a pretty cool magical flight, you know, through an area that's heavily magical. For our rescue from without, I moved a little bit into the future, away from the traditional Harry Potter series. Apparently, and I haven't read The Cursed Child, this is simply from the internet, but apparently he had a child with Bellatrix, and this is someone who can attempt to reclaim his legacy even after he is gone. So there's a chance for him to be rescued still through his child. For the crossing of the return threshold, we have the walking back into the conquered Hogwarts. This is that return threshold. The beginning of the journey was at Hogwarts. Now he's re-entered it as its conqueror. Good crossing of the return threshold. For the Master of Two Worlds, we have him being the Master of Death, as well as the strongest wizard, now that Albus Dumbledore is out of the picture, and that pesky little child Harry is out of the picture. Unfortunately, his freedom to live is lacking, as at the very end of this, he is in fact defeated by Harry, and then goes to live in essentially this purgatory limbo that we're supposed to assume is like only for the worst of the worst. And
hey, that was all in Harry's head, and we don't know what Voldemort saw in his head. Maybe Voldemort just goes where all dead souls go in 8 different chunks. So, Alex, what are your thoughts on Zach's wonderful return?
Well, I don't think it's wonderful, but definitely. The one point that I'm not really going to argue is the refusal of the return. I think that this was an astute observation by Zach, saying that Voldemort hasn't realized that he's won. He's not really accepting it. Having someone go check, I think that's the best we're going to be able to get from Voldemort here. For a magical flight, does not pass out. He falls down. Harry passes out.
Momentarily unconscious.
No, they're both unconscious for the same amount of time.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
When did this, how?
In the forest, right after there.
When Harry comes back to consciousness, that's when Voldemort gets back up.
Yeah, they knock each other out.
But Voldemort lost conscious?
Yeah.
No, what?
Yeah, because it's like, it's supposed to be a mirror of what's happening to Harry.
Huh. I never got that, but.
Okay, yeah, because, right, Harry, we don't know how long it is, but they were both. They shoot it, and that's why Voldemort has his refusal and he makes somebody else go check, because all the Death Eaters were just standing around waiting to see what the hell had happened.
Okay. I did not realize that Voldemort lost consciousness, but that actually makes a lot of sense. I don't know how I never picked up on that in the dozen or so times I've read that 7th book, but whatever. For our rescue from without, first off, Voldemort doesn't need no saving. I don't know why you think he does. He doesn't need a rescue. And second, God, why did you remind me of this book? This stupid
play? Isn't it technically a play?
It's
a
play. Why did you remind me of this?
More importantly, she fails to accomplish anything, so she does not rescue him.
All right. So going on to our crossing the return threshold, kind of like I already wanted to say, for the Tome with a Creator, walking back into the conquered Hogwarts that again isn't really conquered. He has it for
even if he doesn't conquer it, he's still walking back into Hogwarts, which is where this all began.
All right, so he's sharing the wisdom of conquering his... the world, the wizarding world.
He's sharing the wisdom of his, I am in charge now and you have to deal with it.
Okay. Can we say that he does this when the sharing of this wisdom lasts seconds?
Minutes at least. Thank you.
Like 30 seconds. I don't know. Do all of the other houses cease to exist very briefly when Voldemort declares that all
houses? If we were to look at the sand in the house cup area, if they cease to exist, then we need to tweet at J.K. Rowling and find out on the status of houses during this intermediary period.
And that will be our deciding factor.
Master of Two Worlds. Master of Death. No,
he is not.
Harry was that. Strongest wizard. I mean, I have no way of knowing this. Dumbledore and Voldemort never had a real duel. And the closest thing got is the myth, and Dumbledore won. Yeah, exactly. And then Harry killed Voldemort, so also no. And freedom to live. Is the freedom to die?
Yeah, there we go. Pass.
That is going to bring us to a close on the return with more points than I would have expected. That rescue from without, Master of Two Worlds, and Freedom to Live missing, putting us at a final score of 10 out of 17. Thankfully, meaning that we don't have to call this villain's journey a successful hero's journey, which is satisfying on multiple levels because one, not a hero. Two, man, Voldemort is a shitty villain. So I'm kind of glad that he didn't get too many points. He's stupid and makes bad plans. That is gonna bring us into our closing thoughts. These episodes are weird, but I kind of always find them to be fun to talk about characters that are explicitly not heroes. And God, Zach having to do research on the cursed child was just a chef's kiss, beautiful extra bonus, because now he has to suffer the way the rest of us suffered. He now knows what happened. Harry Potter's a blast. I think on this reread, I found my favorite books to be 3, 4, and 7. And
oh, wait, we have to do our definitive rankings of the books.
Oh, I did. I did say 7. We hold them to definitive rankings. For me, favorite order on this reread. So definitive in as much as, currently definitive. It went 4, then 3, then 7, then 5, then 1, then 6, then 2. I don't know if it's just my bias from the movies as a kid, but 2 has always been my least favorite Harry Potter book. It's not bad by any means. It's just not my favorite or my least favorite. Passing it over to Alex.
Okay. So I'm going to do my rankings at the end. And I think this is going to be the episode where I complain about Harry Potter a little bit. I do want to say I always loved Harry Potter, despite the issues with it. Just kind of like Narnia, it got me into reading, and I'm always going to love this series. But I think there are 2 things in the story that are just bad and could have been better with a different writer. The consistency of the magic is just not great. Can you operate without a wand? I don't know. Do you guys know?
No, but I was a child and hard magic systems didn't mean anything to me before.
Is there a limit how far you can operate? Any clue?
No, but they never seem to use it to just fuck off to a different country, which would have been way smarter.
There is a limit to how far you can operate. Someone talks about having to travel closer so they could operate to the specific location.
Oh.
Why? Why is there a limit?
Is there a distance to how far you can port key?
I don't think so.
Well, that's regulated magic.
And then
also,
like, just
regulated magic can be detected, but only some of the time.
Yeah, and then there's inconsistencies even within the 7th book. Harry and Ron sometimes can operate on their own. Sometimes they can't. Sometimes they need Hermione to be with them. And it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I just think more consistency with the magic and some just general story points would have been good. And then Slytherin. Slytherin is an issue how it's written in the book.
I am wearing a Slytherin shirt right now, so be careful.
I think
those are my people you're talking about.
I think the
I bleed problem, silver and green.
The problem is there's no good Slytherin characters. not like they're not good characters.
That they're not. We've got Stalker Boy Severus Snape. He's not got many redeeming qualities in a real world, but in a book, he comes across well. Yeah, in the end.
So see, that's the issue. I think there should have been someone else in Slytherin who was sympathetic, even if it's just one person. If we had an Ernie McMillan or Justin Filch Finchley, whatever, like one of those people from Slytherin who was like friendly, you could
tell they were a good person. Slughorn does the right thing and helps to fight for Hogwarts rather than fleeing.
But we just don't have any children. So I think like that could have been good. All of the villains that we meet, except for Peter Pettigrew, are Slytherins, even if all of the Slytherins aren't villains. So it would have been interesting to have someone from Ravenclaw be a villain too, or Hufflepuff. Just I just
do anything. Oh,
I'm a Hufflepuff. So I just don't like the villains being just from Slytherin. And I don't know. I think it should have been different.
Well, we have Scorpius Malfoy, who's a good guy.
Uh-huh. And to kind of end out rankings for this, for the series.
Ultimately starts down the wrong path, but Regulus Black.
Oh,
yeah.
But he's not shown like firsthand. We just get him in the background.
Look, I'm doing my best here, okay?
Again, there's just no one in like Harry's class or entire time at school.
Yeah, you could have made like the keeper on the Slytherin team not be a massive douchebag.
Yes, probably could have. But anyway, happier. My rankings for the series this time through. 5, I always love Order of the Phoenix. 7, just because it's a capstone. 3, everybody likes 3. 4, 1, 6, and 2. Similar to Jack, I don't know. 2 is like the weakest book to me.
Which is a shame, because Gilderoy Lockhart is fun on rereads as an adult, but he's like, the book just kind of glazes, my eyes kind of, thinking about it, my brain glazes over is what I was trying to say.
So 6 is definitely lower for me because of the movie. I can't help it. It's just really hard to separate those two.
I really enjoy Harry Potter. I remember my dad reading me the first 2.5. And then he started falling asleep, so I had to start reading them myself if I ever wanted to get any sort of resolution. I don't like J.K. Rowling's attempts to stay relevant beyond writing. She wrote that one book under a pseudonym, and it was not very well received. That was when I was working in a bookstore. And the fact that it got leaked was a little too convenient for her non-Harry Potter novel. But she still gave us Harry Potter, and I can't fault her for that. My rankings come at 4 because the Triwizard Cup is chef's kiss. 1 because I've read it the most, and I think its somewhat lighthearted nature makes it a strong contender. 3's time magic aside, is a top quality book. 7, mainly because I enjoyed the somewhat gritty realism, especially Rowling understanding that the readers who had started reading the books at the beginning had matured and therefore have deserved a series that matured with it. I think that was probably the best thing Rowling did for Harry Potter, because there is certainly a motivation and a world in which you could write all 7 Harry Potter books from the lens of the first Harry Potter book, and kept the target audience the same. And the fact that we get the 7th book the way that we do, I think, is not only a good decision, but well written on her part. 6, because 6 probably the one I read third most. But I'm putting it third from the bottom, or third last. Second, mainly because I liked the diary a lot, and I liked the basilisk, but I just doesn't match the other ones. And then five, I really just didn't like five. Wasn't a big fan.
Wow, you and I are opposite on five. Wow.
And that is going to bring us to a close on our time in the Wizarding World. It's been a pleasure being here, and thank you so much for everyone that's taking the time to listen to all of our Harry Potter episodes. If you like Hero's Journey as much as we love doing it, don't forget to leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts from, and we have our polls on Spotify, which you can answer if that's where you get them from. We promise we only make fun of you a little bit when you respond and we don't agree with you. As always, I've been your host and judge, Jack.
This is Alex.
And I'm Zach.
And join us next week when we'll be headed back to the world of the Grisha to close out our time with the Shadow and Bone series with Ruin and Rising.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely true. So moving on to our Atonement with the Creator.
And it's only because of the immortality thing, not because of anything else.